Morning, everybody, on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Baltimore City's Health Commissioner Lena Wen joins us for our monthly Health Watch conversation. Prince's death has been ruled an accidental overdose on the powerful drug fentanyl. Lena Wen is a national leader in the fight against opioid abuse. We'll talk about that and the recent White House confab about social entrepreneurship in Baltimore and educating folks about the dangers of sugary drinks. We'll also hear from three local directors who are coming out of the wings to hit the stage for a play at the Single Carrot Theater. Then, celebrating Bloomsday in Chestertown, bringing James Joyce's iconic work Ulysses to life. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Cohesion Theater's production of Neverwhere. Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Lena Wen joins me again in Studio A. She is Baltimore City's Health Commissioner and our guest each month for a series we call Health Watch. We have conversations about issues affecting the health and well-being of Charm City residents and anybody who residences anywhere else. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you too, Tom.
So we want to talk about sugary drinks today. We're going to talk a little bit about a thing you did at the White House with some other folks from Baltimore. But I want to start with Prince and the medical examiner in Minnesota has declared that he died of an overdose of fentanyl. You're going to be speaking tomorrow at the Clinton Foundation meeting that they're holding in Atlanta with President Clinton in attendance about opioids. This is something you've been a national leader about. What do you now know about what's happened to Prince, and how can that inform us in terms of policy moving forward?
Well, what we see with opioid overdose is that addiction does not discriminate. Overdose does not discriminate. It doesn't matter if you are a famous individual. It doesn't matter your age. You're all at risk. Fentanyl, we know, is a growing problem here in Baltimore as well. It is an extremely powerful opioid. Actually, it's 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine and dozens of times stronger than heroin. And it's now being mixed in with heroin, and people don't know it. And so we're seeing people overdose from fentanyl. The number of people overdosing from fentanyl here in Baltimore City has increased by 7 times in just the last 2 years alone.
What's it usually prescribed for?
I use it in the ER if a patient has just been in a terrible car accident, they're screaming in pain, their hip is out of joint, and I have to reduce their joint. I mean, it's for that level of extreme pain. And this is another reason why we encourage every one of our residents here in the city to get trained in using naloxone or Narcan. You can visit don'tdie.org, our website, and learn to use this life-saving medication. It'll save your life. Overdose from heroin, from fentanyl, from prescription opioids as well. And it's something that we can all do today.
And Prince was evidently not like your textbook drug user. He was not a recreational drug user from what people have at least reported heretofore. So he was using this for pain, and evidently he accidentally overdosed. I mean, do you concur with that finding from what you know about that case?
Well, we do know that the number of people overdosing from prescription opioids has quadrupled in the last 12 years across the country. And we know this is something that we see all the time as physicians. I've seen children accidentally take their grandparents' medications that are lying around. I've seen people take too many of their prescription pills without realizing how dangerous they can be. And that's another reason to always ask your doctor about what is the right amount that you should be taking, what are the side effects, what are the alternatives, and to always have naloxone or Narcan with you.
Dr. Lena Wen is the City Health Commissioner of Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. It's our Health Watch series. I also want to talk to you about an event that was held at the White House last week about social entrepreneurship, particularly about Baltimore. And I guess this grew out of the uprising in April of 2015. And there were a whole bunch of folks from Baltimore, including yourself, who spoke at the White House. What was that? What happened over there?
Well, the spotlight has been on Baltimore in some not so great ways. And I'm glad that we had the event last week where the White House, the Aspen Institute, and one of our local nonprofits that I'm very fond of, Baltimore Corps, came together to highlight the great things that are happening in the city. And people may not think of Baltimore necessarily as the hub of social entrepreneurship. And they certainly might not think about local government as that instigator. But I was proud to represent the health department and speak about how local government can be that catalyst for transformative change. And I joined our nonprofit leaders, including the leaders from Thread, from Merit Baltimore, and others who are doing incredible things in our city. You know, I'm reminded of a quote by Congressman Elijah Cummings, one of my heroes, who talks about how we should not be aiming for common ground, that actually we should be looking for higher ground. And I think that's what we do here in the city. We don't just want for Baltimore to be as good as other cities or meet the expectations of local governments around the country. We want for Baltimore to be the model that others look to as an example. And that White House event was an ideal place to showcase all the great work that we're doing. For example, reducing infant mortality to record lows. For example, with our aggressive overdose campaign that's being modeled across the country. For example, with our Safe Streets and Violence Prevention Programs. And I was very proud to stand with our other leaders to speak about the great work that is happening here in our city.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting and indicative of your approach to this particular job. You're the city health commissioner, you're a physician, but you're talking about street violence, you're talking about entrepreneurship, you're talking about, you know, fixing the problems of the city in a very holistic way. I mean, this is a health issue to you as a physician, isn't it?
Absolutely. Every issue can be tied back to health in some way. How can we speak about the future of our kids and their ability to learn without also addressing their vision? That's why we launched Vision for Baltimore, to get every child glasses. If a child can't see, he or she will be put back in school, maybe labeled as being disruptive. That's a health issue. Same with criminal justice. We can't talk about crime without addressing mental health, without addressing addiction. And it's that understanding of health as it ties to everything. And I would say it's not just about health. It's about the well-being of our community, physical, spiritual, emotional well-being. And that's what we work on from the vantage point of the health department.
And one of your big initiatives now, you testified about this in front of the City Council of Baltimore last week, about a proposal to require warnings about sugary drinks. You're taking on an issue that Mike Bloomberg took on in New York and others have picked up on across the country. But sugar in our diets is clearly a problem, not just for adults, but for a lot of kids as well.
For the first time in our history, we are seeing this absolutely disturbing trend that sends shivers down my spine, which is that we're seeing our children come in with diseases that we used to only see in adults. I'm seeing 14-year-old kids have adult-onset diabetes. I'm seeing 16-year-olds who begin to have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, even heart problems. I've seen 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds come in with morbid obesity. And these are issues that are resulting in early death for generations to come. And yes, there are many contributors, but we know that one of the biggest contributors to childhood obesity is soda, is sugary drinks, is added sugar in our diets that have no nutritional value. And so we also know that this is not just a health issue, but a civil rights issue, a justice issue, because companies disproportionately market their sugary drinks to communities of color, communities in low-income areas like ours. And our parents and youth leaders have been telling us that they see these ads by Beyonce and some sports stars about why these drinks are so cool to drink, but they don't know about the health risks associated. And that's why kids are drinking not just one soda a day, they're drinking 8, 10 sodas a day that are cutting short their lives. And so our legislation that we support, that Councilman Mosby introduced, is to put a warning label at places where sugary drinks are sold and on advertisements for sugary drinks so that we level the playing field of information. This is about education. It's about getting the word out about the importance of watching our diet and the importance of health for the livelihoods and futures of our children.
So let's make sure folks understand what this proposal proposes, which is this is not labeling the containers. So the manufacturers are not going to be required to stick a warning label on the container the way cigarette manufacturers are, for example. But I guess this is signage that has to be prevalent in places where these kinds of beverages are sold.
Imagine if you are thirsty and you walk into a gas station or a corner store. We want for individuals like you, if you're thirsty, when you walk in, to look at a sign and say, oh, I was going to get a regular Coke, regular Pepsi, but now that I see that that it's a reminder that sodas contribute, sugary drinks contribute to obesity, diabetes, and tooth decay, that you will reach instead for water or diet soda or something else without that added sugar. You're not going to go away thirsty. So there is no anticipated impact on our retailers. They're not going to lose the business. You're not just going to say, well, I see the warning sign, so I'm not going to buy anything at all. And there is no cost to manufacturers, as you mentioned, because there is no cost of additional printing. This really is about education and about empowering parents in particular to make the best choices for their children. That's why this idea didn't come from us in the health department. It didn't come from scientists. It actually came from parents. It came from pediatricians. It came from youth groups who are asking us for education to make an informed choice.
And it's an education campaign that's, as you say, going up against folks like Beyonce, who was paid by some reports $50 million to be an advocate for, you know, a spokesperson for Pepsi. You've got a lot of advertising, obviously, that's going to counter this, which is to say, this is an approach that has to do with education rather than revenue. Philadelphia has Philadelphia City Council has in front of it a proposal to tax soda and to tax sugary beverages and then use that money to pay for education and other programs. This is not a revenue generating proposal. You're taking a different tack here.
Our tack here is the easiest, simplest, smallest step that we can possibly take to reduce childhood obesity here in Baltimore City. It really is simply about education and an informed choice. That said, we last week at the city council hearing, we saw how much money the industry is already spending on countering this very basic educational campaign. Every year, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising, hundreds of millions of dollars or more on lobbying efforts. We don't have that funding. We don't have that money. What we do have, though, is the will of our community. We had hundreds of community members representing various youth groups and unions and churches and sororities. NAACP came out in support of our legislation because it really is about choice. We had over 2,500 signatories on our petition for this campaign, including by leading pediatricians from every hospital and university here in Baltimore City, because this really is, the science is clear, and all we're doing is allowing for people to make an informed choice about what to do with their bodies and their future.
Okay, Lena Nguyen, always good to see you. Thanks so much.
Nice to see you too.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is Baltimore City's Health Commissioner. She's our guest each month for our Health Watch series. We'll have a link to more information about the proposal to require warnings about sugary drinks on our website. Come on over to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, we'll meet three theater directors who are taking a spin as actors in a new production at the Single Carrot Theater. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to talk about theater coming up. Jaywin Russick will have her weekly theater review. We're going to talk to some folks who are involved in a production at the Single Carrot Theater. But before we do, We want to send our thoughts and prayers out to Ron Legler. He is the president of the France Merrick Performing Arts Center, which includes the Hippodrome here in Baltimore. He was also the founder and owner, co-owner of Pulse, the nightclub in which the horrible massacre took place over the weekend before he came to Baltimore. He was working in the theater community in Orlando, and he started this nightclub with the sister of a good friend of his. And he is down there now, as we understand it, according to the Baltimore Sun, checking in on his former employees and friends and connections in the Orlando area. So our hearts are with Ron Legler, whose connection to this horrible massacre over the weekend is quite a personal one. We're going to talk about the independent theater scene here in Baltimore. It has grown exponentially in the last decade. Center Stage and the Everyman Theater remain the city's most visible professional companies. The Chesapeake Shakespeare Company certainly raised its profile when it opened its beautiful new theater on Redwood Street in 2014. But groups like the Single Carrot Theater, the Interrobang Theater, and the Annex Theater Company have all contributed to a rich tapestry of theatrical activity in Charm City that has transformed people's expectations and accessibility to a wide range of dramatic offerings throughout the year. One of the things that has struck me about this explosion of theater in Baltimore is the cooperation and collaboration between many of these smaller companies. The current production at the Single Carrot Theater is a perfect example. Midlife is a play that features the artistic directors of three local companies who have suited up in costumes to play roles. Genevieve DeMai of the Single Carrot Theater, Katie Heilman of the Interrobang Theater Company, and Evan Moritz, the artistic director of the Annex Theater, are all cast in Midlife in this world premiere by Ben Hoover, and they join me in the studio this morning. It's good to see all of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So, Evan, or Genevieve, let me start with you. This is a premiere of a play by Ben Hoover. Who's Ben Hoover, and why did you pick this?
Ben Hoover was a company member at Single Carrot for a few years, and then he left Single Carrot to go get his MFA from Columbia in playwriting, and he just graduated. And he sent us this piece, and we were really interested in it and excited about it. And one of the things that we do is do work by up-and-coming playwrights, hopefully people that, you know, you see them for the first time at Single Carrot, and then in a few years you see them going on to, you know, amazing things and hearing about them on the national scene. So that's really, we were really compelled by the piece, and then also, we have the personal connection to him as well.
Yeah, it's great. And your whole season this year, I think, is first performances, either local, regional, or world premieres.
Yeah, for the
pretty
most
much,
part.
Right?
Yeah, definitely regional premieres. And then we had three world premieres and one regional premiere.
Yeah, so you're doing a lot of new work all
exactly.
the time. Yeah, that's great. And Evan, give us a sense of the plot of this play. What happens?
Oh, gosh. you gave me the hard one. That it is a play that takes place in the main character Beck's mind mostly, but also in the external world. Her mind is actually being taken over by another woman. And the central conflict is that this other woman who's starting to invade her thoughts and her mind is trying to actually completely take over the character and become her. I guess that's probably the shortest summary I can give of
yeah,
this.
There's a barista making her coffee,
right.
And she and Beck are, they're close. And
The barista goes missing, and then
right. yeah,
and then this other woman is assuming her identity.
Yeah.
And I'd say it's kind of a metaphor for change and aging and moving through life and the choices and compromises you make about identity.
And so midlife in this context is, Katie, is defined as in your 30s. Is that right?
We were actually talking about that when Ben came to see the play the other night, because we were talking about, you know, you usually think midlife is more 40s, 50s. So why are we using a 30-something woman to tell that story? And I think the issues that Beck deals with are kind of universal. Like they're not limited to someone in their midlife. I'm using air quotes. So I think it still works, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, just for those of us who haven't been in their 30s for a while, you know, if 30s is midlife, there are a few of us who are in trouble, let me tell you. Well, you it's know, all relative, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there have been multiple, you know, the the other woman who's taking over her body is in her 50s. And so some people have looked at it as her in her midlife looking back on her earlier life. As we've had discussions with people, it's a play that's open to a wide variety of interpretations, yeah. which is really interesting. Yeah. Everyone kind of brings their own perspective and own issues to it and interprets it through that lens.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see the play yet, but I did read the script. And Katie, I mean, when you read a script like this, when Genevieve or whomever came to you and said, hey, what do you think about this project and do you want to be part of it? What do you look for in a play, especially obviously a piece that's brand new? You will not have had any other interaction with it at any other time.
Sure. I mean, I love working on new work. I prefer doing things that have never been done before. And so when I signed on to do the play, which I think the majority of us, we had no idea what it would be. So we didn't get the script till way later. Kelly McCleary, the director, she was like, do you want to do this new play? And I was like, of course. So you just sign on not knowing what it is. And then you see it. And this play in particular is like nothing I've ever worked on. I mean, she's Beck, the main character, is sort of speaking all of her thoughts and actions. And you see it all played out. There's little subtext left for interpretation, but I think that's really interesting. I mean, coming from a world of like psychological realism, which is what I primarily deal with, it's which is all subtext and that dramatic tension from that. So seeing a play that has a totally different form, I mean, there's definitely that in midlife, but seeing a play with a totally different dramatic structure is really interesting and fun to work on.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. That's Katie Heilman. She's here with Genevieve DeMahi and Evan Moritz. They are three of the artistic directors of three terrific theater companies here in Baltimore, and they're all starring in a new show at the Single Carrot Theater called Midlife. So, Genevieve, how did this project come to include your two colleagues from these two other theaters here in town?
So when we were looking to cast the play, Katie actually auditioned for our season, and through kind of a standard process, she auditioned and we liked her and we called her back and then
Thanks.
We still liked her. And, I mean, we like people who we don't cast as well, but she was right for what we were doing. And actually, to be honest, and these are things that you don't usually say to actors when you cast them, but she was a really good mover and we knew we wanted to do a lot of movement in the piece. And so that was one of the primary reasons we cast her in addition to her acting talent. And then for Evan, we were looking for someone to play my husband in the play, my character's husband. And so we were reaching out to people who we thought would be the right fit for that role. And so Evan came in and auditioned and it wasn't a
purposeful thing to say, oh, let's get three theater companies together and get the artistic directors and put on a show.
Yeah, it happened
just
more
sort
by
of worked out that
by,
way.
Yeah, circumstance. And then we were like, oh, this is really cool. We have all these leaders of all these companies. And, you know, we work with other theater companies a lot with different actors and other members of those companies. But the fact that it turned out that we had three different leaders of these companies was exciting.
I mean, Evan, am I right in thinking that there really is a great sense and tradition of collaboration among companies here in town. I mean, it seems like, you know, folks are working with Annex are working with all these other companies as well.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the crucial and key things I think that defines this theater community. And in a sense, I mean, Predator had two governors, but we have three artistic directors in our in our play. So in a way, we're better than the movie Predator. But I actually think that what is excellent about our theater community is precisely that, the overlap, the level of blurring that occurs, the sense that it's about the show that people want to do, and that different theater companies, as a result, get to define themselves less by who they are, but what kind of work they do that draws people in over and over again.
But can you deny, Katie Heilman, that there still is competition? I mean, you know, if folks go to Single Carrot this week, that may mean, oh, I've done my theater thing for the month, so I can't go to the next show of Interrobang, or I can't see the show in July by Annex. Do you find that that happens? Does one cannibalize the other?
You really don't feel that in this community at all. I mean, everyone sort of knows everybody, and everyone's helping each other out, and we're all promoting everyone's shows. And I mean, yeah, I think that's why artists like doing theater here, is because you don't have pressure to fill seats, or, you know, people who are doing work in Baltimore are doing it because they want to do it. And, So I think there's like a certain passion that everyone respects and shares for everyone else's work. I mean, that's why, I mean, when we got started, I think Interrobang is the newest company here, definitely. And everyone sort of welcomed us with open arms and was open to what we were doing. So, I mean, it's a really supportive, loving community.
Yeah. And Genevieve DeMai, Single Carrot, will celebrate its 10th anniversary next season. This is the final show of this season, right? You are one of the original carrots. You are one of the folks that came from Colorado 10 years ago. The company has changed. You have a number of people who are, you know, now been with the company for several years. But do you think Baltimore, in the 10-year perspective that you have now, has Baltimore started to become a theater destination for theater artists, people who want to make work?
Yeah. I mean, I've met, you know, when we first moved here, and we would tell people, we're here to start a theater company. And the biggest question that people, the thing that people would say when they responded would just say, why? And we'd be like, well, we're doing this thing, and it's trust me, it's going to be awesome. And they were like, okay, sure. But now, you know, there are people who move here. I know a lot of artists who have moved from D.C. or moved from other places because they're attracted to the art scene and the theater scene here, because there are so many opportunities and such a wide range of work that's being done in the independent theater scene that, I mean, I'd love to see it even become more of a destination. I'd love to see it be nationally known as a destination rather than more regionally known as a destination of, oh, this is where exciting new things are happening.
Yeah. I mean, it was a big risk for you guys to come. You know, there's that old joke, there's a surefire way to make $250,000. You start with $500,000 and you start a theater company.
Right.
You know, it's perfect. You know, you're good to go. So, Evan, what's it like making this switch from, or is it much of a switch from artistic director to actor?
It's completely different. I'm not even sure how to explain it. It's a completely different art form. The choices I make as an artistic director, and particularly I think less so as an artistic director, and more it's easier to speak to it as a theatrical director. As a part of my role as the artistic director of Annex, one of my bigger duties is to direct shows for the company. And in directing, the scope of the project I look at and how I think about the project and how I attack it and how I bring other collaborators and myself, and how as a director you kind of end up being the pivot point or the fulcrum on a show, is wildly different from where I'm at.
It's a different set of chops, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, a completely different set of chops. Yeah. And it's what's cool about it, though, is that it's not that the art itself is all that different, but almost like in a fractal like sense, it's self similar at a different, smaller level. There's as detailed a sort of world there.
Well, I think it's great that you guys are all getting together and doing this, and break a leg for the rest of the run. Appreciate you guys coming in.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
All right, Genevieve DeMai, she's the artistic director of the Single Carrot Theater. Katie Heilman is the artistic director at the Interrobang Theater Company. And Eva Moritz heads up the Annex Theater. You can catch them in the world premiere of Midlife at the Single Carrot Theater on Howard Street in Baltimore until June 26th. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, for a link to details about showtimes and tickets. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later on the broadcast, how the city of Chestertown is celebrating Blooms Day on Thursday. But first, more on the local theater scene. Stay with us. British writer Neil Gaiman is one of the world's most celebrated authors of fantasy novels. So expectations are high for Cohesion Theatre Company's stage adaptation of his supernatural British television series and book, Neverwhere. Maryland Morning theatre critic J. Wynn Russick ventured into this brave new world. Here's her review.
In the world of Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, there are talking rats, duplicitous angels, and immortal assassins. Most of the action takes place below ground in the London sewers and subway or tube. The supernatural goings-on include a girl who can walk through doors where there are no doors. With so much imaginative material, you might expect the theatrical adaptation of Neil Gaiman's fantasy novel to take its own leaps of fantasy. But ambitious as Cohesion Theatre Company's efforts may be, in many respects, director Brad Norris's production and playwright Robert Kozlarik's script are too literal an interpretation of the book, a book that was itself adapted from Gaiman's BBC TV series. The play follows the adventures of a good-hearted London businessman named Richard. He comes to the aid of a bloody, battered young woman who has collapsed on the street. From then on, his life is never the same. Almost immediately, Richard is visited by a pair of sinister gentlemen, Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar, who are looking for the young woman. Their resume is formidable.
Might I, with due respect, remind you that Mr. Vandemar and myself burned down the city of Troy? We brought the Black Plague to Flanders.
I like doing that.
We have assassinated a dozen kings, 5 popes, 50 heroes, and 2 accredited gods. We are utterly professional.
Matthew Payne's Mr. Krupp is as excessively genteel as he is malevolent. But like many of the show's performers, when Payne starts yelling, his words get lost. The young woman turns out to be named Door, presumably because she can go through doors, even when there aren't any. Corey Diacchino's Door has an intense but impish quality. Though for a character in dire straits, Diacchino's emotions remain on a surprisingly even keel. Door lives in the underside of London, the sewers and subways. When Richard, played by Joseph Coracle as a bumbling nice guy, decides to follow her, he finds himself in a dark and dangerous world. Escape is difficult, if not impossible, as Jonas David Gray's character explains.
Look, you can't go back to your old home or your old job or your old life. None of those things exist anymore. Up there, you don't exist. You must understand this. There are 2 Londons. London above, where you lived, and London below, inhabited by the people who have fallen through the cracks. Now you're one of them. You'll just have to make the best of it down here in the sewers.
Like all good fantasy stories, Neverwhere involves a quest, several quests. Richard's quest is to find a way home. Dor's quest is to find out why Krupp and Vandemar killed her family. Even Dor's fierce female bodyguard, played by Cassandra Dutt, is on a quest to slay the great beast of London. The central structures in designer Kel Milioni's set are 2 wood enclosures the size of cargo containers. These are wheeled around by cast members and used to represent everything from bridges to subway cars to a labyrinth. But they're cumbersome and do little to distinguish between London above ground and London below. I read Neil Gaiman's novel before seeing Cohesion's production. But Neverwhere has so much plot, so many characters, and yes, so much social commentary, the heights, the depths, the light, the dark, I'm not sure how clear it is to the uninitiated. Mostly, though, Cohesion and playwright Robert Kozlarik missed a chance to be as creative in adapting the novel as the novel is itself. Only when we finally meet the Great Beast of London, a marvelous 2-person puppet created by Elizabeth Roscoe's, do we get a glimpse of the artistry that might have made this fantasy fantastic?
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down.
Cohesion Theatre Company's production of Neverwhere continues at United Evangelical Church in Canton through Sunday. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. Early Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews plays and all things thespian for us on Monday mornings here on Marilyn Morning. Next week, she'll tell us about Cockpit in Court's production of Godspell. This Thursday, people around the world will be honoring Irish writer James Joyce's classic novel, Ulysses. Coming up after a break for the news, an English professor and an actress join us with a preview of Bloomsday in Chestertown. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
I'm Tom Hall. It is Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. We're going to head over now to Chestertown, where on Thursday, they'll have their second annual Bloomsday celebration. Literature lovers will convene for a free day of dramatic performances, recitations, food, and drink to celebrate Irish writer James Joyce's iconic novel, Ulysses. Bob Mooney joins us from the campus of Washington College in Chestertown to discuss the festivities. He's a professor of English and creative writing at the college, and he'll be leading a discussion of Ulysses on Bloomsday. Melissa McGlynn joins us as well. She's a pastry chef at the Evergreen Bread Company and an actress. Will be performing at the Bloomsday celebration. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So, Bob, what is Bloomsday? How did it start? And what's so significant about Thursday? The date is June 16th.
June 16th, 1904, is the day that the novel is set. It takes place in one day. Joyce's inspiration for writing it and setting it on this day was it was the day that he met the love of his life, Nora Barnacle, whom he was with and started a family, lived in Europe with her for the rest of their lives. The day itself centers around a number of characters, primarily Leopold Bloom, thus the Bloom in Bloomsday. And we follow Bloom around Dublin in this beautiful novel and sort of become part of it in the process. And Bloomsday celebrates that sense of community and being part of that community through literature.
So, full disclosure, I have not read Ulysses. It's one of the many deficits in my things I haven't done in my pathetic life. But if I understand correctly, does the whole novel take place just on one day? I mean, so this
yes.
this day is the whole novel, right? I mean, this is.
It is, and the Ulysses part of it, it links it to, you know, Homer's epic, and the idea is that in the modern world, and through Joyce's way of seeing life, every day is an epic. It's filled with its wonders and horrors. It's filled with life. Every day is a life, and the structure of the novel sort of underscores that.
And Melissa, you're going to be performing Molly's soliloquy, which is a very famous passage in the novel. I guess it comes towards the end. Can you set us up and give us a little sample of Molly's soliloquy? What are you going to be talking about?
Well, the end of the novel is basically one long sentence that is Molly, and she is falling asleep, and it's her train of thought that jumps from one thing to the next, and I have chosen just a small little passage to read for you today, if you'd like me to do that.
That'd be great. So Molly, we should say, is Leopold's wife, and this is a little bit from the soliloquy by Melissa McGlynn.
The sun shines for you, he said the day we were lying among the rhododendrons on Houthhead, in the gray tweed suit and the straw hat, the day I got him to propose to me. Yes. First, I gave him a bit of seed cake out of my mouth, and it was leap year, like now. Yes, 16 years ago, my God. After that long kiss, I near lost my breath, yes. He said I was the flower of the mountain. Yes, so we are flowers. Yes. That was the one true thing he said in his life. And the sun shines for you today.
The sun shines for you today. From Ulysses, Melissa McGlynn, reading Molly's soliloquy. She'll be doing a much longer set of that on the Bloomsday celebration on Thursday. So, Bob, what makes this novel so iconic? Why is there such a following? I mean, I can think of movies that have sort of cult followings,
right.
You know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, and it gets shown at midnight every night and Kenmore Square in Boston. I think they're still doing it. I think they've been doing it for 40 years. But I can't think of another book that has this, because
right.
this Bloomsday celebrations happen all over the world, not just in Dublin and certainly not just in Chestertown.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the cult is everybody alive at any given time. I mean, we're all invited into this book, and it's iconic in the sense that it is for everybody. You mentioned earlier that you said, I haven't read it. I would suggest that it's a book that you don't so much read as experience. It's a place. that's there for you to go to. Of all the books that I've ever experienced, there's no mediation. There aren't even quotation marks. And it has this reputation of being very difficult, but really the novel tells you how to experience it as you go along. It doesn't convey information. It gives you an experience. It offers you an experience. And every time you read it, because you're so invested in it and your life is, it's different. And I think Bloomsday has sort of grown and it's expanding because of this idea. People realize this is a place to meet that counts, and we're going to experience it together.
And Melissa, as an artist, when you're performing work from Ulysses, you're going to be in the middle of the street in Chestertown on Thursday doing this long thing. How important is context for the listener? Because Ulysses, as Bob said, you know, it's kind of an intimidating thing. I mean, there are people who, like me, who think they should have read it. We should have taken a course on it. We should have, you know, been good human beings, but we weren't. I mean, how important is it for folks standing on High Street in Chestertown to know any of the background to understand what it is you're conveying?
Well, I think it's my job as an actress to experience the truth of what Molly is saying so that I can allow the audience to experience that truth as well. So I will do my best, but I think context, whether you know the book or not, hopefully through my performance, I'll be able to convey the truth of Molly.
And Bob, you're going to be giving a talk about it with a couple of other scholars, and that's just sort of one of several other events that's happening. How have you put this thing together, the whole day's worth of events?
Kelly Castro has put together a beautiful day of many events, of which Melissa and I are part and happy to be. I'm going to be actually initiating a conversation in the spirit of the novel with the folks that show up. It's not going to be so much a lecture as a conversation, which the book is. I'm not really speaking as a scholar. I'm a writer. A friend of mine who's a poet and also a professor will be there. But the professor thing is something that Joyce joked about. He said, I've written a book that's going to keep the professors talking for 300 years.
He was certainly right about that, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
He was, but it's not so much. He was kind of, on one hand, you know, talking about the spirit of the book. On the other hand, saying, well, professors are only part of the game here. They're only one group. This is a book for everybody, and it's not an intellectual exercise. It's as I said earlier, you know, it's a human exercise. This book is about life. It affirms life, and it ends with the word yes. You know, it's really about love in a world filled with sometimes not love.
And Chestertown's a great place to visit, and this is as good an excuse as any to go down to Chestertown and have a good time. Well, thanks both of you for coming by. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The actress Melissa McLean. On Thursday, she'll be performing at Bloomsday in Chestertown in celebration of Ulysses by James Joyce. Bob Mooney is a professor of English and creative writing at Washington College. He'll be leading a discussion of the iconic novel as part of the festivities. Events start Thursday at 9 in the morning. For information, visit our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Join us Wednesday. I'll speak with Baltimore County Executive Kemen Kamenetz. Musician Teddy Abrams joins me as well to talk about the National Orchestra Institute and Festival in College Park. Until then, for Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Writer's Almanac is up next. Have a great day.